Hello, welcome and kumusta. Thank you for joining me. This is How, your occupational therapist, and welcome to Occupational Therapy Conversations. In this episode of OT Conversations, I'd like us to have a conversation and a little talk about this condition called MND or motor neuron disease. This is suitable to any professionals learning in the clinical field, occupational therapists, those who are working in neuro, those who are working in respiratory medicine. It is quite frequent, or therapists working in such areas would encounter this condition. This is especially relevant to occupational therapists, any other therapists, and anybody who's curious, really. The definition of motor neuron disease, if you just look at that and look at the words motor, the neuron disease, so there's the disease of the motor neuron. And this motor neuron disease, or MND, is a group of progressive neurological disorders. And these neurological disorders destroy the motor neurons. And these motor neurons, what are these? These are nerve cells that control voluntary muscle activity. And it may involve muscles of speaking, muscles that will have something to do with walking, something to do with breathing, and even swallowing. The most popular type is the ALS, or the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And it's often called or known as the Lou Gehrig's disease. Lou Gehrig was a very popular baseball player back in the days, and he had this problem. Motor neuron is a general group. There is a few types. The first one being what I said, ALS, the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And this injures, or this affects both the upper and lower motor neurons that are affected. And this is the common type. Upper motor neuron being coming from the brain, and the lower motor neuron would be the one that is in the spinal cord. Another type of motor neuron disease would be the progressive bulbar palsy, or the PBP. And this will affect somebody's speech and swallowing. Another one would be the progressive muscular atrophy. This is primarily the lower motor neuron that's being affected. And then the last one would be the primary lateral sclerosis. And this one affects the upper motor neurons. In terms of the causes and the risk factors, most of the time we don't know what the case is. Idiopathic is what you would call. But around 5 to 10% are familial, where there can be a mutation of particular genes, complex genes. What would be the risk factors? Age? I wouldn't say age is a risk factor. It's just that it's been established at around that age, really. So it is identified around the age of 50 to 70 years old. Male are more affected than women, slightly more common. He said that having a family history of this is a problem, and it may possibly be linked to some environmental toxins, viral exposures, but still under an investigation. What happens during the MND? What is the pathophysiology? What is the physiology of these diseases? Technically, the motor neurons, they degenerate and they die. And when they degenerate and when they die, the signals that are coming from these motor neurons, remember that these motor neurons would be the origin of the movement. The signals that would come from here will weaken the muscle. Because first and foremost, like I said, you need the nerve electrical impulse from a nerve for the muscle to contract, and it will produce acetylcholine. Acetylcholine will release all these calcium ion channels and all these the cross bridges in the muscle contraction. So if there is no acetylcholine, then the muscles, the signals from the muscles to the muscles gets weakened, and there's no signal, then the muscle will waste. And then eventually, once the muscle wastes, then you will have paralysis and you can have respiratory failure. And with an upper motor neuron problem, meaning the brain or the spinal cord, there can be stiffness, there can be spasticity. And where there is a lower motor neuron, which would be peripheral nerves, then you can have weakness, atrophy, and you can have fasciculations as well. Okay, so what's happening? What are the symptoms? You can have muscle weakness. Initially, it will be focal. You can have difficulty with grip strength, or you can have foot drop. And then you can have muscle twitching, like fasciculations. You can have swallowing difficulty, or one can have swallowing difficulty, or dysphagia. One can have slurring of speeches. You can have spasticity, or one can have spasticity. Emotional lability, though one can definitely be affected emotionally because of this, because you are slowly seeing yourself unable to do the things that you need to do, and yet your mind is still practiced or working very well, and you know what's been happening. So it must be very, very, very frustrating. One can have breathing difficulties, and then weight loss and fatigue. Most of the time, cognition is preserved, but up to 50% may develop some type of frontotemporal dementia symptoms. What's the disease progression? It's gradual, so it is a chronic condition. It is deteriorating, and it can lead to a complete paralysis. Most of the time, people survive from 2 to 5 years after the diagnosis, although some live a little bit longer, like Professor Stephen Hawking, for example. And the most common cause of death would be respiratory failure. How do medics diagnose this? There's no single test. The diagnosis is clinical, and it can be supported by the EMG, which is showing denervation. MRI can be done as well, so that one can exclude mimics, like cervical myelopathy. One can do blood tests just to rule out metabolic infections, autoimmune causes, and genetic causes. Genetic testing is one. So medics would do a lot of things about this. It's all medical interventions. They would have some medications that they would want to do, but it's all about symptom management at the end of the day. If there's spasm, for example, then a person might be given antispasmodics like baclofen, for example, or they might be given antidepressants. Or if breathing becomes difficulty because the muscles are getting very weak, then one can be given an NIV, which is a non-invasive ventilation support. It can be a CPAP or a BiPAP if indicated. And then when it comes to feeding, so it's very hard to train the swallowing because it's deteriorating. And to be sure and to be safe, one needs to be provided with a peg. When we are approaching this problem, we're talking about a multidisciplinary team, really. It's a team. It should be a team. So doctors would do what they need to do. They would always consult the doctor first. And then everything else will be done by therapy, and it depends on the scope of therapy. For example, for occupational therapy, we can be dealing with environmental adaptation, modified home environment. We could be providing the person with adaptive aids to make it easier for them and for the carers to look after them, like hoists, for example. Seating becomes impaired because one may have difficulty restoring the postural control. Then you need a proper wheelchair, proper seating support. Fatigue management, making the most of their abilities and doing some pacing. We can have hand function support as well, whether we use splints, we use adaptive aids, or on how we can make it so much easier for them. And we can advise them and help on sleep positioning, particularly when they're using CPAP or BiPAP. In this country, it depends on who would be concerned about that. I'm sure in the hospital, nurses would have a lot to do with that. But when they go home, then you need to maximize that. Then occupational therapists can help, particularly on the provision of some sleeping systems. But then the challenge would be the funding and sourcing out where these sleeping systems would fall under. So there has to be an advanced care planning as well. With physical therapy, what would be the physical? Can they restore the muscles? Probably not. But they can maintain the joint range, so you have to do joint range exercises to prevent contractures. And speech and language therapists will be talking about some communication aids. Although in the States, in North America, OTs would be doing this because this is functional communication. And these are adaptive aids that we can use. We can explore on that one as well. Swallowing assessments in this country would do that. In the States, swallowing is done by occupational therapists. Dietitians for nutritional support. And the PEG decision is a team effort, can't be the dietitian. Palliative care team would have to be involved, particularly with symptom control and with end-of-life discussions. That's about it. A few more additions to what we can do as occupational therapists. We can support functional independence as long as possible. If we want to maintain a person's level of independence, we do everything that we can to promote that sustained level of independence. We can teach people about energy conservation. And don't say you don't have time, because if you're working with people with MND, this is what you need to do. It will be difficult, particularly with a person losing their roles and identity. And that is best addressed in the community. So proper occupational therapy or community-based occupational therapy is recommended. We can coordinate assistive technology and home adaptations. And in other places, if it is the field of specialization for an OT, we can assist with emotional coping and facilitating communication with family and carers. Although palliative care team would have to be thinking about this, but then occupational therapy is holistic and it is the nature of what we do. If there is a problem, it becomes an occupational concern. If it's an occupational concern, we need to address it either by restoring, but in this scenario, we cannot restore it a lot. If anything, we can maintain and we can prevent, we can support, we can adapt and modify. In terms of other key considerations, just remember, guys, that psychological impact is immense and patients may face anxiety, depression, grief. What about exercises? Can we give exercises to patients with multiple sclerosis? The answer is yes. Absolutely, we can provide people with MND, but there's a big but. But with very important caveats. The caveats would be that the goal of exercise should not be for strengthening of the muscles. Okay? It's not to strengthen the muscles in a traditional sense. We should be giving exercises for the following reasons. One, to maintain mobility and joint range. The second one, we will give exercises to reduce pain and to prevent contractures. Again, that's the joint range talking in there. The third one is to reduce spasticity and stiffness. That's why you just need to do gentle stretching. Another one is to support respiratory health, particularly the trunk muscles. You know, you don't exercise it, then everything would just be reliant on accessory breathing muscles. And you do that because you want to enhance the quality of life and independence for as long as possible. Right? So the general principles, really, one, you have to tailor it to the person's ability and depending on the stage, right? If they're already weak and it's quite severe, why would you give something that they can't do? You would just frustrate them even more. You need to focus on engagement, a person doing it, low intensity, functional, energy conserving movements, right? General principles would be for us to monitor the fatigue levels, and you don't want to overexert the person as well. Just the right balance. That's what's required. If needed, you can rely on using the adaptive aids. And there's a balance and there's an art in there. Because you don't want to give adaptive aids too soon. You don't want to give it too late. You just want it at the right time. So what are some of the adaptive equipment? You can have grab bars, mobility aids. And you want to integrate all of these two daily activities. That's why most OTs don't do exercise anymore, because you just want to make sure that things are being done through their ADLs and through their engagement. All right. There you go, guys. I hope you learned a little something today. Is this motor neuron disease in a nutshell? I don't know if it is helpful. To me, it's one of those conditions that all I need to know is it deteriorating? Yes. And therefore, I need to know what to push. I need to anticipate for the future. So knowing that it is progressive and deteriorating, that's one factor in here. Knowing that overexertion can produce more damage to the person, that is another thing as well. And really, what I'm saying, with occupational therapy, there's just no form. The form of occupational therapy will present itself depending on how the person presents. Right. Okay. I hope you learned a little something today. If you like it and you learned a little something, talk to your colleagues about it. Talk to your friends over a cup of tea. Learn together. Grow together. Just remember, guys, anything you do matters and has an outcome. This is your occupational therapist, Hao. This is a relevant information involving occupational therapy, which makes this a riot conversation. Until next time, bye.